You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with The Deal Farm on today's Best Deal Ever episode. I've got Paul Elliott. Paul, how you doing?
I'm good, Ken. How are you?
I'm doing very good. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
No worries.
So Paul is the co-founder of The Smart Millionaire, which you can find him at thesmartmillionaire.com. But he's also the co-author of The Lifetime Money Machine, which was just recently launched on Amazon and shot right to number one. Before that, he was an entrepreneur. He's been an entrepreneur for the last 30 years and a real estate investor for the last 20. And he's got a real interesting story. He's based in the UK. I'd love to hear kind of how you got into real estate, how you got into forming the Smart Money Millionaire, and just take us back. How did you get started?
Well, right back at the beginning. I guess like a lot of people, my parents raised me with that kind of philosophy of work hard at school, get good grades. And they really were keen for me at that time to go through college, university. So I was the first person in my family ever to go to university. So everyone was really proud, especially my grandma. And I then came out with a degree and went to get a job. So I headed down to London. I got a job as a software writer, so basically a coder at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was there for about 9 months, I think, and then I got fired. Yeah, they said I had a bit of an attitude problem, which I didn't really understand. But anyway, they said this. And so off I went and got a second job. And I worked for the IT department of a bank. And I was there for about 6 months. And I came in one morning and got called into the director's office. And he said, "You're fired."
Not an attitude problem again, was it?
Well, yeah, I guess I had an interesting approach to work. I kind of didn't see the point of somebody sitting at a desk for 12, 13 hours and achieving very little when you could achieve the same amount in a couple of hours and take the rest of the day off. So that was my philosophy. But they didn't agree with it, I guess.
You'll figure.
So I left there. Funnily enough, I came home from that being fired that morning, and my flatmate at the time, who was working in a bar in the evenings, and he was home. So I came in. He's like, "What the hell are you doing home?" And I said, "Well, I've been fired." And he said, "Oh, that's great." He said, "Take a look at this." And he showed me. He was just rung and responded to an advert in a local paper, which was looking for sailing instructors to go to the south of France and work the summer in the south of France teaching sailing. And my flatmate, it was called Piers, he was from Cornwall, which is down on the coast in the UK. Mm-hmm. And so he'd grown up with the water, surfing, sailing, the whole works. He was like a master yachtsman, the whole nine yards. And I said, "Well, you know, mate, I've never been in a boat." He said, "Don't worry about it." So literally I got on the phone, I rang this number. The woman who answered asked me, you know, what I was responding to. I said, "Look, I saw this advert for a sailing instructor, blah, blah, blah." She then starts asking me what qualifications I had, at which point I'm putting my hand over the phone and saying to Piers, "What qualifications have I got?" So he's telling me what I need to say. So I'm repeating this to this woman. She's then very excited. She's like, "Oh, this is fantastic." You know, she's just what we're looking for. And she said, "What's your address?" So I gave her my address, at which point she's like, "Didn't I just hear this?" And I said, yeah. I said, "You just spoke to my flatmate, Piers." I said, "We used to work together in Cornwall." And she's like, "Wow, I've got a team."
Oh, my gosh.
So I said, I'm laughing at this. And of course, 2 days later, Piers and I headed to the south of France and spent the summer in the south of France. So I had a job there, which was great. I didn't get fired from that one, but obviously it didn't last very long. And then I came home and I went into my third and final job, and I was there for a year. And what was interesting about it was initially it was a young business. It was a high street fashion company. So it was based on Oxford Street in London. So it was a young business. So going in the morning was very exciting because things would change on a day-by-day basis. Mm-hmm. So what I didn't realize at the time, it was still very entrepreneurial. I didn't have a label for it then, but I found it really exciting. But then as it started to grow, of course, then like any business that grows, at some point you have to bring in the professional management, the suits. So as they came in, it wasn't as interesting. It wasn't as exciting anymore. So at that point I started to lose interest, and shortly after that they fired me again. So that was kind of it. So I was like, I realize now, I realize I'm obviously not meant to work for someone else. So I launched my first business. I knew absolutely nothing. I didn't even know what the business was going to be about. I just thought, well, if you're going to have a business, you need an office. So I decided to get an office. So I rented an office in Leicester Square in London, which if you are looking for prime commercial real estate, that would be one of the places to purchase. If you were looking for the most expensive office in London, that would be a place to buy it. So I basically rented this office, and I knew, as I say, I knew nothing. So it was like I just had to kind of find a way, and I sort of stumbled. I discovered an interest in psychology, so that got me started in that, and then I developed a business around that, so that got me going there. And then as I started making money, I thought I need to do something with this. So I started literally just, again, very green about it, but just buying property. So just finding a way to, you know, once I had enough money for a deposit, then I would buy another property. Mortgages were very easy to come by back then. So we're talking kind of like, you know, the 1990s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very, very easy at the time. And certainly in London, you know, prices were going up. And then there was a crash, which was fine because, one, there was no shortage of tenants. So it didn't really affect me in the sense of I didn't have to sell. So, you know, my tenants were still paying the rent. I was still paying the mortgage. It wasn't an issue. But in terms of what I experienced, what I saw was obviously prices dropping massively. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, this is a fantastic time to buy. So I did. I just continued buying. And so when the property started to come out of that again, and it was a genuine crash. We haven't had a crash ever since, but it was a genuine crash then. Hmm. So as property started to climb out of that crash, obviously I was then very well set in terms of equity and lines of credit, which then allowed me obviously to do bigger deals and so on. So
I'm curious. Back then and even still today, do you guys have access to a 30-year mortgage, or what are your mortgages like in the UK?
Yeah. You can still get a 30-year residential mortgage. Probably, 25 is still more common.
Okay.
20 is still there. You can get any length of mortgage. You can negotiate anything you want, really, with a mortgage company. It just depends on their parameters. But
yeah.
30 years is still available.
But more typical for you guys is a 25-year?
Yeah, or even a 20-year now.
You know, a 20-year,
What's changed, I would say, since the sort of global financial meltdown has been that the mortgage companies obviously have tightened the parameters of how they – lend money.
Sure.
So in the residential market, there's certainly more, they require a bigger deposit. So what that has then done, of course, is because everything has a knock-on effect, and it's very interesting how people don't necessarily think these things through, but it has a knock-on effect, because if you make it harder for people to get on the property ladder, so to speak, if it's harder to get on, then of course somebody wanting to sell, there becomes this kind of chain reaction all the way through.
Right.
So that was more difficult. So suddenly the mortgage companies, I don't think this ever happened in the States, but in the UK, at one point during the sort of madness that was going on before the meltdown, there was a company called Northern Rock. They're no longer in business anymore. And they were providing 125% mortgages.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So in other words, you could get 125% of the property you were buying, which is just madness. It's like you buy the property and you still got 25% in your pocket. So because they were just expecting that prices would continue to rise and nothing would ever change. But of course, that wasn't the case. It was always going to change at some point.
You know, we weren't far from that, man. We had some madness in the mid 2000s with the option arms. Basically, you choose your amortization. And I'm sure there were some equity lines that were over 100% at some point in time. We know all about just ridiculous. Yeah. Have you seen the movie I actually just saw it this weekend. It was really, really entertaining, called The Big Short, that just came out. Really, it's about the U.S. meltdown and kind of how it really takes you back to exactly the conditions and how we got to where we were. But it was exactly that. It was all the crazy mortgages that were being dealt to everybody.
Yeah. It was just crazy, absolutely crazy. But still, you know, from my perspective, and I've one of the things I've seen, I think we talked about this just before we started the podcast properly, was this idea that, you know, I've had people approach me asking for help with buying or building a property portfolio. So they're looking at me as a mentor and asking me to help. Mm-hmm. And I've done this. I did this for a few years. I did it quite regularly for a few years. And one of the things I noticed was that 99.9% of people never had a strategy. So they would come to me and say, you know, I need help doing this. And they'd have absolutely no idea, which is great. It's a bit like the empty cup. Then you can fill it up with the right stuff. Mm-hmm. But you also had people come in and saying, look, I've got this property deal. What do you think? And it's like, I don't think anything. It's like, you know, they're like, well, is it a good deal? Is it a bad deal? It's like, I have no idea. What's your strategy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And until you tell me your strategy, I've got no way of evaluating whether this is good for you, bad for you, or what it's going to do for you. Are you, you know, as a simple question out, first question out really was, are you looking for equity? Are you looking for income? Are you looking for both?
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking for something which, you know, are you going to look down the line 10 years and go, this portfolio that I've built gives me a line of credit like this, which then launches me into commercial property,
mm-hmm.
or this kind of thing launches me into bigger deals, or do you want to be wholesaling in the sense of, do you want to be buying and selling property or buying and selling portfolios? You know, I mean, at one point I was literally not just buying for myself, but I was buying for other people as a sourcing agent. I was literally negotiating deals on portfolios and then moving those across to other sophisticated investors who wanted a whole portfolio to purchase. And anything from kind of like the smallest portfolio might be three or four properties to, you know, like buying 80, 90 properties in a portfolio straight off, you know. So there's also things about, but you've got to know what your strategy is. And I think that's kind of the big thing with property. And that's the one thing that I see is missing most of the time with people who are looking at property and saying, this is going to make me financially free. Yeah. It can, you know, and it's still doable today, but you got to understand what your strategy is going in and you got to stick to your strategy.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And you know, our business in Atlanta, we sell a lot of properties to investors, and we have the exact same conversation. The first time we talk to an investor, it's, okay, what are your goals? Where do you want to be in 10 years? You know, are you just trying to make some quick cash on fast appreciation? Are you in it for the long haul? You want to pay these houses down and have, you know, a lot of cash flow. What are you looking for? And you got to know that before you start buying. Otherwise, you're just throwing darts at a board aimlessly.
Yeah, completely. Completely. I mean, you could be building a portfolio where you're looking down the line 20 years and saying, okay, in 20 years, I want to be able to take half my portfolio and, you know, liquidize it, sell it, and then pay down any debt outstanding on the other side of the portfolio. And then just have a portfolio which carries, you know, no encumberment, but just gives me a larger income. And then maybe if it's wrapped up in a trust in some way at that point, because it could easily be done then obviously it becomes a legacy for your family, for your children, or whatever else you want to do. But yeah. See, which ties is like, you know, you've got to know the end game. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, you know, when Greg and I first met, one of the things that Greg really brought, which I'd never seen explained in this way, was understanding what the end point is. And he talks about it in terms of your wealth pie and your income P. I mean, you mentioned, you know, I'm co-author of the book Lifetime Money Machine. Mm-hmm. And this is all, you know, part of the sort of thinking process that Greg and I follow. So everything, our end game is understanding what is your wealth pie, what is your income P, and what do they need to be to give you the life and the lifestyle that you want, because that's your end game, that's your goal. And as long as your wealth pie is balanced, you will never have any problems. I'm sure you've seen this as well. I've seen people buy 45 properties in a year, mm-hmm. and I've seen them go bankrupt in less than 12 months.
Yeah, wrong properties, wrong timing in a lot of cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And no understanding. I mean, like basic things. And I'm not trying to pretend that I haven't made mistakes. I've probably made more mistakes than anybody. But, you know, things like buying property and then not understanding that if it ain't tenanted, you've then got to find the money to keep covering those mortgages.
Right.
Or leveraging so high that they're putting themselves in a position where it's very difficult. Like they lose one tenant and all of a sudden they've got problems. You know, the worst one I ever saw was a guy who came to me and he literally, his portfolio was costing him in pounds, about £5,000 a month. Hmm. So, you know, he was having to find, like, for the average person trying to find £5,000 disposable income, mm-hmm. to cover a portfolio, which he was hoping was going to be his pension fund. That ain't easy. You know,
yeah.
So,
you know, there's a lot. It's funny because I remember when I first got started about 10 years ago, there's a lot of these no money down techniques. And a lot of people are advertising these courses about how to buy houses no money down. And I was just scratching my head. I was like, that's great if you can buy the house, but I know intuitively that you need money to continue to support the house. That's great, yeah, that somehow you got the house, but what are you going to do after you buy it and you don't have money coming in? Then what?
Yeah, exactly.
You're just stuck.
You're stuck. Yeah. You know, you've got to, and I've seen people where they've just gone into it and bought property after property and they've built up on paper a great amount of equity. But then, of course, from a cash flow point of view, it's very limited. And if they're having to find money to keep that portfolio afloat, then obviously it becomes difficult. And yes. Then it's a question of balancing the portfolio. You know, so it's like, well, can you bring in, like, for example, multiple occupancy type properties if you want to stick with a residential model, bring in multiple occupancy properties, which then generate massive cash flow, yeah. but are not going to give you a lot of equity. And if you're thinking, what's your exit from something like that? Then probably only another investor is ever going to buy it. You know, so it's not something you could, like with a residential property that's, say, like a simple family unit.
Yep.
If you wanted to sell it, then obviously your options are you could sell it to an investor, you could sell it to a family, you know, or you could option it to a family. But if you got something like, you know, where each room is rented to, you know, a house of multiple occupancy, as we call it, then of course the only person who's really going to buy that is another investor. A family's not going to buy that and go through the work of trying to convert it back into a normal family home, you know. Yep. So,
right. Yeah. Well, so you know, in the U.S., a lot of our investors diversify by buying in different markets. that have different aspects to it. So like some markets are high appreciation markets where you might not get a lot of cash flow, but then they'll diversify and go into the Midwest and buy in Memphis or Indianapolis or somewhere where you don't necessarily have a lot of growth, not a lot of appreciation, but they're high cash flow. And so when you're assembling a portfolio of properties, you're buying in different markets specifically for those reasons to diversify.
Yeah, to keep it balanced. Yeah, I mean, I would say in the UK, you have a similar idea. So although the UK is only a fraction of the size of the States, certainly in the north of the country, so getting up towards sort of Liverpool area, Manchester area, and further north into Newcastle, mm-hmm. then you have still as a culture, a lot of people in those areas who in their mind, they will rent for life. They will never own their own home, and they never believe they will own their own home. So consequently, you can buy properties there which are very cheap, which, are, like you say, are not going to get a lot of appreciation. You're not going to see a lot of equity, but you will get good cash flow from them. You still see decent yields, you know. So even today, you can get decent yields on them. So
Interesting. Where the south, closer to London, is more of your growth markets?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And obviously, and London is kind of unique in its own right. You know, the obviously London, the demand in London and the number of people in London is so great that, you know, one, you could buy a property there and obviously get great appreciation and great cash flow if you've done it right. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it, of course, you get a lot of overseas investors coming into London. So, you know, at one point we were doing deals where they were just literally, finding properties for people who were overseas, high net worth individuals who just wanted to buy property in the UK purely from an investment point of view. They didn't, to a certain extent, some of them didn't even care whether the property could be tenanted. It was just somewhere for them to purchase and obviously then just wait for it to continue to grow, you know. So
interesting. Yeah, I remember when the Chinese economy was a little bit stronger, we saw some of that in the US, that there was a lot of, you know, the wealthy Chinese that were just trying to get their money out of China and they were just parking it in properties. I'm sure this was true in the UK. They didn't care if it's tenanted or not. They just wanted somewhere safe to park their money. Yeah. And obviously expect some appreciation in the process.
Yeah, yeah. Which also, you know, then will drive up prices.
Yeah.
You know, then you're kind of like, well, what's supporting that?
You know, that's so right.
That's where you got to take a longer view and look at it and go, is this realistic? Because it always, you know, I would say one of the things that I thought Robert Kiyosaki in his book made a comment, and I don't think he necessarily meant it this way, but he made this comment that you make your money when you buy. Mm. And I would say there's a huge amount of truth to that. And some of it is kind of looking at the deal and saying, okay, if I buy it at this price in the current market, is that the right price to be paying for this? Will it continue to give me a return 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line if I'm going to hold it for that long? Or is it inflated at this point, in which case I should be looking for a different deal? You know, and I think most people don't necessarily know how to necessarily evaluate that, or they don't look at the bigger picture in the sense of, like, demographically. I'm a big fan of Harry Dent. I don't know if you follow Harry Dent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like the whole demographic model. It's like, you know, we're already seeing baby boomers who have bought property for maybe the last 10, 15 years or so, or 20 years, with the view that that was going to be their pension fund.
Yeah.
Of course, now they're at a point where they got all this equity, but in order to realize that as cash, because obviously you can't go down to the supermarket and buy your groceries with equity, you've got to have real cash there. Mm-hmm. So in order to kind of release that, they've got to sell it. But who are they selling it to? Because the baby boomers were such a large generation.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously massively, since the Second World War, property prices just continue to rise and rise and rise. I mean, we've seen, like, obviously it will get to a certain peak and then drop a little bit, but then it starts again. So in the UK, it's never dropped back to where it started from, if that makes sense. It always dips, mm-hmm. and then the chart will carry on upwards. So they continued doing this, but they're the reason that chart followed that pattern, because they drove up the demand so much in the UK. And now, of course, they're at a point where it's like, well, I want to sell this. Well, who can buy it? First-time buyers are struggling, because they were struggling to find a 5% deposit, let alone a 20% deposit,
right,
based on what the mortgage company will give them. So, you know, the problem with it is not that property isn't a great vehicle. The problem is they didn't look at it strategically.
Yeah, right.
They just, you know.
Do you guys have reverse mortgages? I'm just curious, in the UK. That's a new product here in just the last couple of years in the US, which sort of solves that dilemma.
Yeah, where you can basically continue living in your own property, but somebody else is kind of taking it on. Is that what you mean?
That's right. So, yeah, every month drawing against your equity.
Yes, that's right. Because
that really filled a big need. Exactly the problem that you described. You got all these baby boomers have all this equity, but they didn't. They needed the cash flow. And so
designed this product. Yeah, so, solves the problem for them.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
You as an investor have still got to look at it and say, you know, what price am I paying for this? Is it worth it? Because obviously that's not if they're drawing income from it, then it's not cash flowing for you necessarily.
Right.
So you know, therefore you're looking at purely as a longer term equity deal, and you're kind of waiting for them. I mean, obviously it sounds very morbid, but you're kind of waiting for them to right. kind of move on to the next stage of their existence in another sphere, you know. So
right.
and you can't hurry that thing along, you know. It's like it's just not, it's frowned upon, you know.
Yeah. So. Hey, so talk to me a little bit about the book, the Smart Money or the Lifetime Money Machine.
Lifetime Money Machine, yeah. Well, basically what happened was, I give you the backstory to this. A couple of years back, so 2014, I was what I would say in between businesses, in between startups, really. And so I'd taken a year off, and then in 2014, I was kind of like kind of getting itchy again. And then a friend of mine gave me a call, and I hadn't seen him for about 6 years. And he was building a business, and it was basically teaching people public speaking skills. And he was doing very well with this business. So he said to me, you know, would you come and kind of help me out with it? Come and do some speaking for me and just help me promote my courses. And I said, yeah, all right. So off I went. And, you know, for about a year, I spent working, helping him. And I flew around the world for him, and I delivered his presentations for him and so on. But one of the first ones I did was in Australia. So I got to Sydney and I did a presentation in Sydney at this event, this kind of multi-day, multi-speaker event. I'm sure you're familiar with them. And I did a presentation there. And at the end of it, Greg came up to speak to me. And I didn't know him at the time. Obviously, just met him. He said he'd enjoyed my presentation, enjoyed my talk. And he said, could we talk further? Because he had an idea that he wanted to run by me. Now, I get that a lot. Whenever I speak somewhere, obviously, somebody comes up to me. He's kind of like, yeah, yeah, you know, I'm always respectful. I'm always polite. Most of the time, these people haven't got anything. And most of the time, there's been a couple of times in the past where I've gone, that sounds really promising, but then they just haven't obviously delivered on their side. So I was a little bit kind of skeptical, but still I said, yep, let's have a chat. So anyway, Greg then actually flew to the UK. This is how committed he was. And he said, listen, he said, my children are now grown up. They're in their early 20s. He said, you know, I've encouraged them to kind of seek a profession because I believe that's a good foundation for them. He said, that's what they're doing. He said, but I have a worry for their generation. He said, it's not like our generation. It's not like you can buy a property, sit on it, do nothing with it, and see it double in value over 10 years. He said, things have changed. He said, so in my opinion, we need a new model for money, a new game plan, if you like. And he said, and I've written it all down. He said, I've put it in a book. He said, but, you know, I'm sort of at that point where I'm kind of easing off the accelerator a little bit. He said, if I left to me, this book's just going to sit here. He said, but I really do want to have an impact. I want to kind of share this message with as many people as possible. He said, I see two major challenges. One is young people. He said, in terms of they're looking at it and either they're never going to be able to afford a property, or they're looking at it and thinking, where's the opportunity for me financially anywhere? He said, you know, because I've spoken to people who are making excellent incomes, you know, so like good six-figure incomes, and they're still scared. He said, and the flip side is, he said, I've had people I've spoken to and who've approached me who are on the surface very successful. He said, they're sort of my age or older. He said, you know, they've got the house, they've got the car, they've got their own business, but they're still scared because they don't see a way of getting out of it. Like they're going to be working till the day they drop. And he said, and I see a lot of baby boomers who are wanting to retire, who are about to discover that all that equity isn't going to help them. He said, so I've written this book to solve that problem. He said, so will you help me kind of get this message out and make a difference? And I said, absolutely. So I read the book. I was blown away by it. And then I obviously, over the next few months, I contributed some ideas to it and suggested certain aspects be rewritten in certain ways. And that's how it started. And then early on in the conversation, you know, I said to Greg, I said, Greg, this is very much a way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So this whole concept that you've taken the way you think about money, and this whole idea of a wealth pie and an income pie, I said, it's absolutely brilliant. I said, it's just amazing. I said, but teaching people to think a certain way can be kind of tricky. I said, whereas there's a quote from Buckminster Fuller, which said, you know, rather than trying to teach people to think a certain way, give them a tool which forces them to think that way. And I said, like, let's turn this, because Greg is numbers based. He is Mr. Number. You know, he's trained as an accountant. He's like, you know, he has spreadsheets for everything, you know, right. So. I said, why don't we take that and turn it into software? Because that would then allow people to, one, not just read the book and go, that's brilliant. How many people read a book? Well, how many people buy a book and actually read it? That's the first challenge. Yeah, and then the second challenge is how many people read it and go, actually, I'm going to apply this. You know, and typically, even if someone is very enthusiastic and really keen and motivated to apply it, they typically will run into problems because it's new to them. It's a new way of thinking. And that's a challenge. You know, it's like overcoming that kind of lizard brain mentality aspect.
Sure.
So I say, if we turn this into software, then it'll be, make it easier for us to help people. So we took the book and then we brought on board a programmer and said, okay, here's what we want to do. And he started developing all the applications and the software for us. So that's how it started. So it became kind of, you know, he met me, it became a software business, and the book is a way of thinking, and the software then supports that way of thinking, both in terms of saying, okay, here's the end game. You need to develop your wealth pie, and PIE is basically your assets. So P are your personal assets, so your car, your houses, your, you know, things that you have in your lifestyle that make your life more enjoyable, make it more interesting, and obviously make you more secure as well. It's obviously like having a roof over your head. Mm-hmm. I is income assets. And an income asset is something that generates an income for you without you being there. So that is where most people fall down. And it's interesting. If you take someone who, let's say, for example, even somebody on a significant salary. So if someone was making $200,000 a year, which would be considered a great salary, and it is a great salary, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's okay, let's draw your wealth pie. We draw their wealth pie and we go, okay, well, you got the car, you got the house, you know, and all this sort of thing. You may have one or two other properties which have got equity in it, including your own home. There may be equity in your own home. But then in terms of income assets, zero. So it's like the only way you support that lifestyle is to continue working. Mm-hmm. You have a wealth pie, which is very vulnerable, and this is a problem. So then your income P is very much how is your income earned. So P is passive income, E is your expenses, and A is active income. Now, of course, your income needs to exceed your expenses. Otherwise, obviously, you're running a deficit, you got a problem. So then whatever that deficit is, of course, you make it up typically with active income. So income where you're exchanging your time for money. But once you understand that the name of the game is to get to a place where your wealth pie is 50% income assets, 25% personal assets, 25% equity assets, that's your end game. That's your goal.
Interesting.
So whatever you're trying to achieve, every deal you do falls into that thinking pattern. What impact does this have on your pie? And once you draw it to me, when you show it to them, they go, I get it. This makes everything so much easier. And that's really what we wanted to get across.
The concepts are very similar to Rich Dad, Poor Dad in terms of owning assets that are producing income for you and change, kind of a mindset shift. It seems like maybe you've put even more numbers around strategically planning for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because it's kind of, you can look at it and say, like, for example, you know, part of it, we have the pi and the p are sort of the basic foundations. But then you also have what we call our navigation control. So that's like, how do you make sure? Because one of the things is, it's not about making money and becoming wealthy. Ultimately, it's about having a more fulfilling life, and it's about having a better quality of life. And yes, money is necessary to be able to get to a certain level. But then beyond that, it's like making money is only step one. Mm-hmm. Keeping money is kind of step 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Right, right.
And it's like, because keeping money tends to be harder than making it. You know, making it, I learned how to make it very early on in my life. Keeping it took me a lot longer.
Well, and then make the three, we think making that money work for you, not just keeping
it. Yeah, yeah. Well, making it work for, yeah, of course, yeah. Making it work for you is kind of like, so there's a feedback loop between the wealth pie and the income pie. Ultimately, like, for example, if you bought a property with a mortgage or with some form of debt, but then that property generates an income. If you can take a portion of that income and use it to continue to pay down the debt, then obviously every time you pay down the debt, then your costs on that debt each month go down. So therefore your income goes up. So now there's more income, so you can still continue to take a piece of that income and pay down the debt. So you can start paying it down faster and faster. And that's the ultimate game. So that doesn't necessarily happen with residential property. That won't necessarily happen on a deal by deal basis, property by property basis, but it can happen on a portfolio basis, if that makes sense.
Sure.
With commercial property, that can happen on a deal by deal basis.
Right.
You know, so one of our big things with commercial is, you know, we're into shopping malls. So with a shopping mall, you can absolutely buy a property and have that property generate so much income that you are paying down the debt on that property annually, which therefore is bringing down your costs on that mall. And therefore, by bringing down your costs, you're increasing your income as well. So each year, your debt reduces and your income increases, and therefore, you can accelerate this whole process. And once you've got all that in place, then you have a lifetime money machine, because it will continue to make you money forever.
Hmm. Talk to me a little bit about what the software looks like. So how does that point people in the right direction?
Well, basically, what it does is the software works by saying, okay, look, you've got three primary vehicles for making money. One is property, and we can break property into residential and commercial. So you've got property, you've got investments in terms of stock, and then you've also got businesses. So you can buy and sell businesses, or you can obviously develop your own business. So those are your three vehicles. If you are looking at a property, property is probably the easiest one to explain. If you're looking at a property, then one of the keys to really making sure a deal is going to be worthwhile for you is literally running the numbers. So we've developed the property app so that we've put in so many defaults for you, but you can change it, but we put so many defaults in, you can literally put in one number, it runs it through for you, and you get an idea of, is this a good deal today? Is this a good deal in 5 years? Is this a good deal in 10 years? And then everything you do, then all of those deals, if you like, all then filter upwards into your overall lifetime money machine. So there is one of the apps is literally called the lifetime money machine. So everything feeds into that one, and it literally plots you your wealth pie and your income pie. So you can see it graphically, because I'm very visual. Mm-hmm. If I can see it, it's like I instantly get it, and it's like, okay, so I can do it. I can run a deal through the software and then look at the impact it has on my lifetime money machine. So in other words, I can look at it and say, okay, this deal is going to help me get to this place where I am effectively financially free in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, or actually this deal is not going to do a lot for me. Or you can look at it in terms of, okay, this deal might not look great today, but actually 10 years down the line, because of where it is and the kind of growth I'm going to get there, then the line of credit it opens for me, even if I don't sell it, the line of credit it opens for me allows me to get into a bigger deal, which if you're going, for example, starting out and saying I want to do residential deals, it may be that 5 years down the line, you're now looking at it and saying, okay, I can use this money to get me into a commercial deal and accelerate the process. So commercial property has much, much bigger factor for generating income as opposed to equity. So therefore, you know, a commercial deal could start generating enough income to pay for your lifestyle and you're done. You know, so it could, so it really just everything plays out in terms of what impact does this deal have on your wealth pie today? What impact will it have in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? And it does all that for you. So it takes the, you don't have to arduously go through and try and put together a spreadsheet for it or try and do the calculations for it. It's done for you. And then you can see it all graphically. So in terms of keeping people focused on the end game, which is your wealth pie and your income pie, and in terms of saying, is this deal, because we talk about wanting people to be more strategic, this forces you to be strategic because you run the numbers, you look at it and go, actually, this is going to have a big impact on my wealth pie. Or more importantly, because this is where it obviously gets more interesting, if you've got three or four deals and you run them all, but you can only do one at the moment, then of course you'll be able to see which one is the one that's worth doing today that's going to have the biggest impact on getting me to that place where I'm financially free and where obviously I'm going to be financially free then for the rest of my life.
And it's balanced too. I like that. So it's not just properties. I mean, if you've got some ownership in some companies or some stocks, you could put that in there and see how it has an effect on your future. And then even businesses, I guess, folks that own side businesses or portions of businesses, how it all sort of feeds into your overall, like you said, your money machine.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly with businesses, you know, if you're selling businesses, you know, different industries have different, different factors in terms of, you know, if you're selling a business, do you get 2x income? Do you get 5x income?
Right.
You know, so, and different industries have different figures for that.
Yep.
The other side of it, of course, is if you're starting a business, then, you know, one of the things we talk about is you want a business to kind of follow the map, which means minimal investment up front. Can you automate it and highly profitable? So a map business to us is the kind of business we'd be interested in.
Yeah.
Because we look at it and go, is there a minimal investment? Can we automate all of it? And, you know, is it highly profitable? You know, so that's kind of how we evaluate businesses as well. So
it sounds incredibly interesting. I mean, and it's like you said, a lot of us have different tools that we use, whether it's spreadsheets or it's a website or it's Money or Quicken or one of those other. But it sounds like you kind of pull it all together and it's always aimed towards the end game, sort of the bigger picture, not just the, you know, it's more the aggregate level than the, you know, the microscopic level.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, you can go microscopic, you can drill down into any aspect of it, but it's very much, and also, you know, you can put in, one of the things I used to be really horrendously bad at was just even having a simple budget for myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas this as a tool allows you to do that. So, and you can put things in, like say, well, if I want to buy I don't know. Have you got a dream car? Do you own your dream car? Have you got another dream car you want to buy? I don't know. But let's say you've got a car you want to purchase and you're thinking, well, I want to have that. And then you can even put that in and it'll run that in terms of showing you the impact that has. If you bought that today, what impact would that have on your wealth pie in terms of shifting the percentage, which is your personal assets versus your income assets versus your equity assets? So you can see the impact there. And obviously you can then see what that's going to cost you over the next year, over the next 5 years, over the next 10 years. You know, so you can go into as much detail as you wish, but But you're right in the sense that the bigger picture, which is the strategic aspect, it keeps you focused on the right end game.
That's pretty cool. I could see plugging in like a boat and red flags go off. Don't do it. Don't do it. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like you can do it, but you need to go find some great deals first to kind of balance back out your wealth pie. You know?
Right, right. So let's shift gears real quick, and we'll come back to the smart millionaire. The show is the best deal ever. You've done a lot of real estate deals in the UK. I'm super curious. Give us an idea of like one of your best deals ever that you did in the UK.
I give you two real quick ones. One is residential, one's commercial. Cool. And one small deal, one's a bigger deal, but the concepts are the same. And I think that's the important part. One of the reasons I got into property in the beginning was, first of all, I was making money. I needed somewhere to put it. Then I lost that business, and consequently, they took everything. All the assets disappeared, and I had to start again. And around that time, my daughter was born. So, literally, I went from all the usual trappings of success to living in a one-bedroom apartment.
Wow.
With a baby on the way. So when my daughter was born, it was like, I need to do something. I need to turn this around. So one of the things that I never thought about was my credit rating. So having lost everything, my credit rating went with it. So trying to raise money through normal channels just wasn't going to work. Nobody was interested. It's like even opening a bank. I couldn't even open a bank account for like a year. It's like nobody wanted to touch me. And I just thought, this is ridiculous. And this was interesting because I used to look at the States and go, over in America, they're much more entrepreneur friendly.
Mm-hmm.
That's still my perception to this day. We had a politician here, Mandelson, years ago, Peter Mandelson, who went over to the States, and we used to have like 12-year bankruptcy laws. And he came back and said, in America, it's like 3-6 months type bankruptcy laws. We should have those here to encourage more entrepreneurs. The only decent thing he ever did in his whole political career. But anyway,
great thing. Interesting.
So he came back. So nobody would touch me. So it was like, well, how do I do this without a credit rating, without the ability to borrow money? And, certainly if I'm wanting to have leverage, which I do, then, trying to save the money obviously is too slow. It's not going to work. So I then came up with this idea for my, I was like sat down one day. I'm a big journal keeper. So I was writing in my journal and just writing my frustrations more than anything else. But it suddenly popped this idea of, well, instead of this whole concept of other people's money, can we not also have other people's credit rating? So I then started actively looking for partners, people who would help me kind of get started. So I was approaching people basically, and it started literally just talking to people at a local barbecue. People that I'd sort of met, like when my daughter was going to nursery and such, like, I might go along occasionally and you'd meet somebody and talk. So then you get invited to a barbecue. So it was like talking in that way. That's where it started. It was nothing more sophisticated than just chatting to your neighbors. And it literally, I was talking to people and I was saying, look, this is where I want to get to. This is where I see most people with a job and the kind of challenges they're facing. And, if you look at all the things that were going on with pensions then, and still are today, in the sense of, will your pension actually support you when you want to retire? So just talking in those terms, being able to sort of say to people, have you thought about your financial future? Getting them to even consider it, getting them to even kind of go back. And I had one woman literally called me the following day. And she said, after you were chatting to us last night, she said, I went home and she said, and I pulled out, we get these letters from the pension company giving us a statement of our pension. She said, I've never looked at any of them. She said, but I got home last night, opened the drawer where we stick all the envelopes. She said, and I pulled them out and I opened them and I read them. And she said, you're right. She said, our pensions are worth less than the money we've paid in.
Interesting.
She said, so I need to do something. Can you help? And that's how my first deal started then. So we built a portfolio as a partnership. I was bringing kind of the skills. I did all the negotiating. I did all the research. I found the deals. I negotiated the deals. I did all of that. She just brought her credit rating.
Interesting. Some money, probably a little bit of equity too, probably.
To begin with, yeah. But what we would do, what I was doing, in my strategy in the beginning was very much to focus on refurbishments or doer-ups or whatever you might call them.
Yep.
So it was literally finding properties, and we picked an area in the UK where I knew a lot of people were moving to. So it was a growing area. So I knew there was going to be more demand as well. So I thought, if we can do a few in the beginning where we just purchase them, renovate them, and then just sell them on, then we can generate some chunks of money, which then allow us to actually start developing a portfolio. And that's what we did. And we got to a point where we were literally doing four deals a month, and we would typically try and hold two and sell two. So it was literally two to sell to generate more money, two to hold to let, and obviously you see the income and the equity growth from them. And that's how it all started. But the key was that, one, anything is negotiable. So whenever you're talking to the vendor, everything's negotiable. Mm-hmm. When you need to raise money, again, everything's negotiable. There's always a way, and there's always, if you have the insight and the skill, then you can always find someone who's able to provide the investment, the money, the capital, the credit rating, whatever you want, whatever it might be.
Absolutely. I think your store is so applicable to probably a ton of our listeners who are maybe down and out because they don't have the credit or they don't feel like they've got the equity to put into. But you basically started this with nothing. You found one credit partner and built an entire business around it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really, it's just one person that can, you know, open the doors if you've got the expertise and the drive to put together an entire business around it.
Yeah, completely. It's like, don't let a lack of money stop you.
Right.
You know, yeah. And I think or as bad long credit. As you none of that can get in the way. If you are, I mean, obviously you're getting more into kind of like the drive and the desire, that's what comes into it more than anything else, but it's that commitment to yourself of like, this is the kind of lifestyle I'm committed to living. Where I am at the moment isn't as good as I want it to be, and I'm not willing to put up with it. And that's kind of how I used to see it. I used to view it that way. It was like, this is not who I am. Living in a manner below which I know I'm capable of doing is not who I am. It's not right for me. It's not right for my family. It's not right for my little girl when she was born. It's like, so it's that's the drive. It's like, find that drive. But there's always help. And I think if you then, I mean, my approach was, I will understand property better than anybody, because I'll be able to bring the skills, the insight, and I'll be able to negotiate better than anybody. And that was my focus. And it wasn't trying to be big-headed. And I'm not saying I am the most informed on property. I'm not saying I am the best negotiator in the world, not by a long shot. But my drive was, I want to be the best in the world at this. I want to be the best in the world at this. So therefore, I was hungry for the knowledge. So therefore, by learning and approaching the people, seeing how other people are structured deals and talking to other people, and you start to meet people who've done all sorts of deals, and you meet people who've got deals and portfolios, and they start having problems, and you can start seeing ways to solve it for them. And property investing is problem solving.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. So that got me started. So yeah, lack of credit, lack of money isn't important, as long as you kind of focus on, this is what I'm going to have, and what I'm bringing to the table is knowledge, is negotiation. It's like, so all those things were areas that I just threw myself at. It's like I went down the library and read books on negotiation, sure, and influence and all this kind of stuff. It's like, this is what's going to make a difference. This is what I can bring, because I can't physically bring money or a credit rating. So right. That's what I did.
So steer people back to the website. I want people to understand, again, that the book is the education piece, but then the software built into the Smart Money Millionaire or the smartmillionaire.com. Do you do webinars or any sort of training so people understand really the benefits of the software and what it looks like? Or are there opportunities for them to use it and really visually grasp it?
Yeah. So the easiest thing, I mean, we do within the whole package of the membership, there is the software, but there's also training videos, which are educational. And also the plan now is to do webinars on a monthly basis as well on all the areas that people are going to have problems with or that they're going to need help with, both in terms of not just focused on how to use the software, but also key skills of understanding property or business or whatever it may be. So we're kind of bringing that in as well. But that's all. Yeah. So it's all in there. You can do a trial membership. That's probably the easiest way to kind of expose yourself to it in terms of getting in there and playing with it and seeing what it can do for you. So yeah, it's probably the easiest thing, which you can access through smartmillionaire.com.
So Smart Millionaire it's really a membership. It's education. It's the tools. It's the resources. It's everything to kind of help move you in that right direction of what you call the money machine.
Yeah, of getting to that place where you have a lifetime money machine. Because the other side of it, remember as well, is us now. I mean, I'm guessing you're a little bit younger than I am, but you know, we now are probably the first generation for whom retirement is going to be as long as a traditional working career.
Yeah.
So like, we're living longer, you know, so it's like you want to retire at 65. In the past, you know, I remember when my granddad, it's like, you know, people retired and then a few years later typically died.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, well, that they set retirement age at like the average death rate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas obviously now, you know, you can look forward to, you know, maybe 20 years, 30 years, maybe longer.
Right.
So it's like you've got all this time. So you need an income to support it. You don't want to be working for the rest of your life until you drop. So,
and that's really what the Smart Millionaire is about, right? I mean, it's essentially, it's training, it's education, it's software, and just helping people to finish well. If you would, again, maybe point us in the right direction. How can people learn more about the book and learn more about the membership?
Yep. I mean, you can, the book's called The Lifetime Money Machine. You can get it direct from Amazon, or you can go to lifetimemoneymachine.com where you can get the book. Basically, if you go to Amazon, you can buy the book from Amazon and they'll give you free shipping. If you come via the lifetimemoneymachine.com, then we ask for a little bit of shipping, but we send you the book for free. But you can also then start a trial membership of the software and everything that's inside the membership area as well. So either way, I would highly suggest grab the book, dive into it, devour it. You know, it's like make notes, change the way you think about money, change the way you think about what the end game is. And my belief and my hope is it would then have a massive impact on you getting to a place where you are financially free, not just today, but forever.
Paul, this has been fantastic. Folks, again, it's smartmillionaire.com. Feel free to check it out. We'll make sure we put it in the show notes as well so you guys have a link to that. Thanks again, Paul. This has been great.
No worries. Thank you, Ken.
Take care.
Cheers, buddy.